History's Book 7, Polymnia. When news of the battle fought at Marathon reached King Darius, son of Hystaspes, who had already been greatly provoked at the Athenians because of their attack on Sardis, he now grew far more indignant still, and was all the more eager to march against Greece. At once he sent messengers around to the cities ordering them to prepare an army, commanding each to furnish far more than before, ships, horses, grain, and transport vessels. As these orders went out, Asia was in turmoil for 3 years, as the best men were being enrolled and equipped to campaign against Greece. But in the fourth year, the Egyptians, who had been enslaved by Cambyses, revolted from the Persians. At that point, Darius was all the more eager to campaign against both peoples. While Darius was preparing his expedition against Egypt and Athens, a great dispute arose among his sons over the succession, since Persian custom required that a king be designated before he went on campaign. Darius had had 3 sons born before he became king, by his first wife, the daughter of Gobryas, and 4 more after he became king, by Attossa, daughter of Cyrus. Of the elder sons, the eldest was Artabazanes, of the younger, Xerxes. Since they were of different mothers, they were in dispute. Artabazanes because he was the eldest of all the offspring, and because it was customary among all mankind for the eldest to hold rule. Xerxes because he was the son of Attossa, daughter of Cyrus, and because it was Cyrus who had won the Persians their freedom. Darius had not yet given his verdict, when it so happened that Demaratus, son of Ariston, stripped of his kingship at Sparta and having exiled himself from Lacedaemon, had also come up to Susa around this same time. Learning of the quarrel between the sons of Darius, this man went to Xerxes, so the account goes, and urged him to add, beyond what he had already been arguing, that he himself was born to Darius after Darius had already become king and already held the Persian throne, whereas Artabazanes had been born to Darius while he was still a private man. So it would be neither fitting nor just for anyone else to receive the honor ahead of him. Demaratus pointed out that this same custom held even at Sparta. If sons were born before their father took the throne, and a later son was born to him once he was already king, the claim to succeed kingship belonged to the one born after. Xerxes followed Demaratus's advice, and Darius, recognizing that he spoke justly, declared him king. But it seems to me that even without this advice, Xerxes would have become king, for Attossa held all the power. Having declared Xerxes king of the Persians, Darius set about his campaign. But then, after this, while preparing his response to the revolt of Egypt in the following year, Darius, after a reign of 36 years in all, came to die, and he was never able to punish either the rebel Egyptians or the Athenians. When Darius died, the throne passed to his son Xerxes. Xerxes, for his part, had at the outset no real eagerness to march against Greece, and instead set about mustering an army against Egypt. But present, and the man who carried the most weight with him among the Persians, Mardonius son of Gobryas, kept returning to this argument, saying, "Master, it would not be right for the Athenians, after inflicting so much harm on the Persians, to escape paying the penalty for what they did. Still, for the moment, attend to the business now in your hands. Once you have subdued Egypt and its arrogance, lead your army against Athens, so that you may have a good name among men, and that in future anyone will think twice before invading your land." This was his argument for vengeance. But to this argument, he would also add the claim that Europe was an exceedingly beautiful land, bearing every kind of cultivated tree, and of surpassing excellence, worthy to be possessed by the king alone among mortals. He said this because he was eager for new exploits and wished himself to be governor of Greece. In time, he worked on Xerxes and persuaded him to do this, and other things happening to coincide helped bring Xerxes around to being persuaded. For one thing, messengers had come from Thessaly on behalf of the Aleuadi, urging the king with every show of eagerness to march against Greece. These Aleuadi were kings of Thessaly. For another, those of the Pisistratids who had come up to Susa were pressing the same arguments as the Aleuadi, and moreover urged him even further still. They had with them Onomacritus, an Athenian, an oracle monger and arranger of the oracles of Musaeus, and they had come up having first settled their quarrel with him. For Onomacritus had been driven out of Athens by Hipparchus, son of Pisistratus, having been caught red-handed by Lassus of Hermione, inserting into the oracles of Musaeus a prophecy that the islands lying off Lemnos would vanish beneath the sea. For this, Hipparchus drove him out, though before that he had made great use of him. But now he had gone up together with them, and whenever he came into the king's presence, the Pisistratids would speak solemn words about him, and he would recite from the oracles. And if there was anything in them foretelling misfortune for the barbarian, he said nothing of it, but chose out the most favorable prophecies and recited them, saying that it was fated that the Hellespont be bridged by a Persian, and expounding the details of the march. So this man came bearing his oracles, and the Pisistratids and the Aleuidae kept declaring their opinions besides. When Xerxes was persuaded to march against Greece, then, in the second year after the death of Darius, he first made an expedition against those who had revolted. Having subdued them and made all Egypt far more enslaved than it had been under Darius, he entrusted it to Achaemenes, his own brother and a son of Darius. Now Achaemenes, while governing Egypt, was later murdered by Inaro's son of Psammetichus, a Libyan. After the conquest of Egypt, when Xerxes was about to take in hand the expedition against Athens, he convened a special assembly of the leading Persians, so that he might learn their opinions and himself state before them all what he wished. When they had gathered, Xerxes spoke as follows. After him, Mardonius spoke. Master, you are not only the best of the Persians who have ever lived, but also of those yet to come, since in everything else you have judged most excellently and most truly, and you will not allow the Ionians settled in Europe to laugh at us, unworthy as they are. For it would be a monstrous thing if we, who have subdued and hold as slaves the Saki, Indians, Ethiopians, Assyrians, and many other great nations that did us no wrong, merely because we wish to add to our power, should fail to take vengeance on the Greeks who were the first to commit injustice against us. Mardonius, having smoothed Xerxes's judgment with words to this effect, fell silent. And since the rest of the Persians were silent and did not dare to put forward an opinion opposed to the one already proposed, Artabanus, son of Hystaspes, who was Xerxes's uncle and relied on that very fact, spoke as follows. Artabanus said this, and Xerxes, angered, answered him thus. Artabanus, you are my father's brother. That alone will save you from receiving the fitting payment for your foolish words. But I do impose this disgrace upon you, since you are a coward and lack spirit. You shall not campaign with me against Greece, but shall remain here with the women. As for me, I will accomplish all that I have said, even without you. For may I not be a descendant of Darius son of Hystaspes, son of Arsames, son of Ariaramnes, son of Taspes, son of Cyrus, son of Cambyses, son of Taspes, son of Achaemenes, if I do not take vengeance on the Athenians, knowing well that if we remain at peace they will not, but will indeed march against our land, if one may judge by what they have already done. They burned Sardis and marched into Asia. So it is not possible for either side now to withdraw. The contest before us is to do or to suffer, so that either all this land shall come under the Greeks, or all that land shall come under the Persians, for there is no middle ground in this hostility. It is right, then, that since we have already suffered wrong, we should now take our vengeance, so that I may also learn what this terrible thing is that I am to suffer, by marching against these men. Men whom even Pelops the Phrygian, who was a slave of my forefathers, subdued so completely that to this very day the people themselves and their land are named after their conqueror. So much was said on this matter. Afterward night came, and the opinion of Artabanus continued to trouble Xerxes, and taking counsel with himself in the night, he found it altogether no advantage to campaign against Greece. Having again resolved on this, he fell asleep, and in the night, it is said by the Persians, he saw a vision of this kind. Xerxes dreamed that a tall and handsome man stood over him and said, "Are you then changing your mind, Persian, about not leading your army against Greece, after having proclaimed that the Persians should gather their forces? You do not do well in changing your mind, nor is there anyone here who will forgive you, but go the way you resolve to go by day." Having said this, the figure seemed to Xerxes to fly away, and when day dawned, he took no account of this dream, but assembled the Persians whom he had gathered before and said to them, "Men of Persia, forgive me for changing my mind so abruptly. I have not yet reached the full maturity of my judgment, and those who urge me toward that other course never leave me in peace for a moment. When I heard the opinion of Artabanus, my youth at once boiled over, so that I hurled at an older man words more unbecoming than was proper. But now I acknowledge my fault and will follow his judgment. So then, since I have changed my mind and will not campaign against Greece, be at ease. When the Persians heard this, they rejoiced and did obeisance. But when night came, the same dream stood again over Xerxes as he slept and said, Son of Darius, you have now plainly declared before the Persians that you renounce the expedition and hold my words in no regard, as though you had heard them from no one. Know this well. If you do not lead an army at once, this is what will come of it. Just as you became great and mighty in a short time, so too you will quickly become humbled again. Xerxes, terrified by the vision, leapt up from his bed and sent a messenger to summon Artabanus. When he arrived, Xerxes said this to him, Artabanus, in the moment I was not of sound mind when I spoke rash words to you in return for your good advice, but not long after I changed my mind, and I recognized that I must do what you had proposed. Yet I am not able to do this even though I wish to, for since I turned back and changed my mind, a dream keeps visiting me that appears to me and by no means approves of my doing this. And just now it has departed after threatening me besides. Now if it is a god who is sending it, and it is altogether his pleasure that the expedition against Greece take place, this same dream will fly to you as well and give you the same command it gives me. And I find this would happen if you were to take all my clothing and putting it on, sit down onto my own throne, and afterward lie down and sleep in my bed. Such were Xerxes' words to him. Artabanus did not yield to the first order, feeling unworthy to take his seat upon the royal throne. But finally, once compelled, having said as much, he carried out what was asked of him. Having spoken those words, and expecting to prove that Xerxes' claim amounted to nothing, Artabanus did as he was told. He put on Xerxes' robes and sat upon the royal throne, and when afterward he lay down to sleep, the same dream that had been visiting Xerxes came to him too, and standing over Artabanus it said, Are you indeed the one who tries to dissuade Xerxes from marching against Greece, as though you cared for him? But neither in the future nor now at present will you escape the consequences of turning aside what was destined to happen. As for Xerxes, what would befall him for refusing to listen has already been shown to him directly. Artabanus took this to mean the dream was threatening him, and that it meant to sear his eyes shut with heated iron rods. Crying out loudly, he sprang up, and taking a seat beside Xerxes, after describing the vision of the dream to him in full, he spoke to him a second time, saying, I, O king, being a man who has already witnessed many great affairs collapse at the hands of lesser men, would not allow you to give way entirely to your youth, knowing how harmful it is to crave more and more. Recalling how Cyrus's campaign against the Massageti turned out, and recalling too Cambyses' campaign against the Ethiopians, while I myself took part with Darius in the expedition against the Scythians. Knowing all this, my judgment was that if you stayed at peace, you would be counted fortunate above everyone men. But since some divine impulse has arisen, and it seems that some god-driven destruction is now overtaking the Greeks, I myself also turn and change my mind, and you should announce to the Persians what is being sent from the god, and bid them make use of the preparations you first proposed, and act in such a way that, since the god is granting it, nothing on your part shall be lacking. When these things had been said, both being lifted up by the vision, as soon as day came Xerxes laid this matter before the Persians, and Artabanus, who before had alone appeared to oppose it, now was plainly urging it on. When Xerxes had set his mind on leading the campaign, after this a third vision came to him in his sleep, which the Magi, upon hearing of it, interpreted to mean that it portended rule over the whole earth and that all mankind would be his slaves. The dream vision was this. Xerxes dreamed he was crowned with an olive branch, and that shoots from the olive spread out to cover the whole earth, after which the crown resting on his head vanished. Once the Magi had interpreted this, every Persian who had gathered there set off at once for his own province, full of enthusiasm over what had been declared, each man wishing to obtain the prizes set before them, and it was in this way that Xerxes gathered his army, searching out every region of the continent. For from the conquest of Egypt, he spent 4 full years preparing his army and what was suited to it. And in the 5th year, as it was ending, he led forth his expedition with a great multitude of forces. Of all the expeditions known to us, none came close to matching this one in scale, so that neither that of Darius against the Scythians appears anything beside it, nor the Scythian one, when the Scythians, pursuing the Cimmerians, invaded the land of the Medes, conquering and settling in almost the whole upper region of Asia, for which Darius afterward took vengeance, nor, according to what is said, that of the sons of Atreus against Ilium, nor that of the Mysians and Teucrians, which came before the Trojan War, when they, crossing over into Europe by the Bosporus, subdued all the Thracians and came down to the Ionian Sea and advanced as far south as the river Peneus. All these expeditions together, even if others were added to them besides, are not worth this one. What people did Xerxes fail to draw out of Asia against Greece? What water fit for drinking did he not exhaust, except that of the great rivers? For some peoples furnished ships, others were arrayed as infantry, others had cavalry assigned to them, others horse transport vessels along with the troops on campaign, others were to furnish long ships for the bridges, and others provisions and ships. And this, since those who first sailed around Athos had come to grief, had been prepared for about 3 years before, the works concerning Athos. For triremes lay at anchor at Elias in the Chersonese. Setting out from there, men of every nation in the army dug under the lash, and relief crews came in turn, and those who dwelt around Athos also dug. Bubares son of Megabazus and Artaches son of Artius, Persian men, oversaw the work. For Athos is a mountain great and famous, reaching down to the sea and inhabited by people. Where the mountain ends toward the mainland, it is peninsula-shaped, with an isthmus about 12 stadia wide. There is a plain here and low hills, from the sea by Acanthus to the sea opposite Tauron. On this isthmus, where Athos ends, the Greek city of Sane is settled, and the cities beyond Sane within Athos, which the Persian was then trying to make into islands instead of parts of the mainland, are these: Deum, Olifixus, Acrothum, Thisis, and Cleone. These are the cities that occupy Athos, and the barbarians dug in this way, having divided the ground by nations. At the city of Sane they made a line with a rope, and when the trench became deep, some stood at the very bottom and dug, while others passed on the earth as it was continually dug out to others standing above on platforms, and these in turn to others, until it reached those at the very top, and these carried it off and threw it away. Now for all the others except the Phoenicians, the sides of the excavation kept collapsing and caused them double labor. For since they made the top opening and the bottom the same width, this result was bound to follow for them. But the Phoenicians displayed their skill in this matter, as in other works too. For having been allotted the portion that fell to them, they dug the upper mouth of the channel twice as wide as the channel itself needed to be, and as the work progressed they kept narrowing it, so that at the bottom it came out even with the work of the others. There is a meadow there, where they had a market and a place of trade, and much grain, already ground, was brought to them from Asia. As far as I can conjecture, Xerxes ordered it to be dug out of pride, wanting to show off his power and leave something by which he would be remembered. For though it was possible, without taking any trouble, to haul the ships across the isthmus, he ordered a channel to be dug for the sea, wide enough for two triremes to be rowed through it side by side. The same men who were assigned to the digging were also ordered to bridge the river Strymon by yoking it together. This is how he did these things, and he also had prepared for the bridges cables of papyrus and of white flax, assigning this task to the Phoenicians and Egyptians, and he had provisions laid up for the army, so that neither the army nor the pack animals should go hungry as they marched against Greece. And having inquired about the locations, he ordered provisions to be stored wherever it was most suitable, bringing them from all parts of Asia in merchant ships and ferry boats to various places. Most of it they brought to a place called the White Shore in Thrace, some to Tyrtiza in the territory of Perinthus, some to Doriscus, some to Ion on the Strymon, and some assigned to Macedonia. While these men were carrying out the appointed labor, meanwhile the entire infantry, having been assembled, marched together with Xerxes to Sardis, setting out from Crotyla in Cappadocia, for it had been ordered that there all the land forces that were to march together with Xerxes himself should assemble. Which of the governors, having led the army arrayed most splendidly, received from the king the promised gifts, I am unable to say, since I have no knowledge that they ever reached any judgment on this matter. But when they had crossed the river Halys and entered Phrygia, marching through it they arrived at Selene, where the springs rise that give rise to the river Meander and to another river no smaller than the Meander, whose name happens to be Cataractes, which rises out of the very marketplace of Selene and flows into the Meander, in which city also the skin of Silenus Marcius is hung up, which, as the Phrygians tell the tale, was flayed by Apollo and hung up there. In this city Pythias, son of Aedes, a Lydian man, residing there, entertained the king's entire army with the greatest hospitality, and Xerxes himself, and he offered to furnish money for the war. And when Pythias offered money, Xerxes asked the Persians who among the men present Pythias was and how much wealth he possessed, that he made this offer. In reply they said, "O king, this man gave your father Darius the golden plane tree and gave him also the golden vine, and among the men we know of, he now ranks first in wealth after you." Marveling at the last of these words, Xerxes himself then asked Pythias how much wealth he had. He said, "O king, I will neither hide it from you nor pretend not to know my own property, but since I know it exactly, I will tell you precisely. For as soon as I learned that you were coming down to the Greek sea, wishing to give you money for the war, I worked it out, and I found by reckoning that I have 2,000 talents of silver, and of gold 400 myriads of Derek staters, lacking 7,000. These I give to you as a gift. For myself, from my slaves and my farmland, I have a sufficient livelihood." So he spoke, and Xerxes, pleased with what had been said, replied, "Lydian guest friend, since I left the land of Persia, I have met no man up to now who wished to offer hospitality to my army, nor anyone who, coming into my presence of his own accord, wished to give money toward my war effort, except you. You have both entertained my army lavishly and now offer great sums of money. In return for this, I give you these honors. I make you my guest friend, and I will make up your 400 myriads of staters to the full sum by giving you from my own the 7,000 that are lacking, so that your 4,000,000 may not be 7,000 pieces short, but the exact sum stand complete through my hand. Keep for yourself what you yourself have acquired, and know how to remain always such a man. For by acting so you will not regret it, either now or in time to come." Having said this and made it good, he went on ever forward. Passing by the city called Anoa of the Phrygians, and a lake from which salt is produced, he arrived at Colossae, a large Phrygian city, where the river Lycus, plunging into a chasm in the earth, disappears, then after about 5 stadia reappears and empties, it too, into the Meander. Setting out from Colossae, the army arrived at the borders of the Phrygians and Lydians at the city of Cydrara, where a stone pillar, fixed in the ground and set up by Croesus, marks the borders by an inscription. When he entered Lydia from Phrygia, the road forks, one branch leading left toward Caria, the other right toward Sardis. For one traveling this way, it is entirely necessary to cross the river Meander and to pass by the city of Calapis, where craftsmen make honey from tamarisk and wheat. Going along this road, Xerxes found a plane tree which, because of its beauty, he adorned with golden ornaments and entrusted to one of the immortals as its keeper. On the following day, he arrived at the city of the Lydians. Having reached Sardis, he first sent out heralds to Greece to demand earth and water, and to instruct the cities to prepare feasts for the king, except that he did not send to Athens or to Lacedaemon to demand earth, but everywhere else. The reason he sent a second time to demand earth and water was this: he thought that those who had not given it before, when Darius had sent for it, would now give it out of fear. Wishing to learn this precisely, he sent. After this, he made preparations to march to Abydos. Meanwhile, they were bridging the Hellespont from Asia to Europe. There is, on the Chersonese by the Hellespont, between the cities of Sestos and Madidus, a broad headland running down to the sea opposite Abydos. There afterward, not long after this, under the generalship of Xanthippus, son of Ariphron, the Athenians took Artax, a Persian man, governor of Sestos, alive, and nailed him to a plank, a man who used to bring women to the shrine of Protesilaus at Elias and there commit unlawful acts. To this headland, then, setting out from Abydos, they built the bridges, with those assigned to the task working on them, the Phoenicians with a cable of white flax, the Egyptians the other with a cable of papyrus. It is 7 stadia from Abydos to the point opposite. When the strait had been bridged, a great storm came up and smashed all of it and broke it apart. When Xerxes learned of this, furious, he ordered that the Hellespont be given 300 lashes with a whip and that a pair of fetters be let down into the sea. I have even heard that he sent branders along with these to brand the Hellespont. He commanded them, as they scourged it, to say barbarous and reckless words. Bitter water, your master lays this punishment on you because you wronged him, though you suffered no wrong from him. King Xerxes will cross you whether you wish it or not. It is with justice that no man offers you sacrifice, since you are a turbid and brackish river. He commanded the sea to be punished with these words, and the heads to be cut off of those who had overseen the bridging of the Hellespont. And those to whom this thankless honor had fallen did as ordered, and other master builders bridged the strait anew. They bridged it in this way, joining together 50 oared ships and triremes, 360 under the bridge toward the Black Sea, and 314 under the other, the ships on the Black Sea side set crosswise to the current, those on the Hellespont side aligned with it, so as to ease the strain on the cables. And having joined them together, they let down very long anchors, on the Black Sea side, because of the winds blowing outward from within, and on the other side, toward the west and the Aegean, because of the west and south winds. They left a gap as a passage among the 50-oared ships and triremes, so that whoever wished could still sail into and out of the Black Sea with small boats. Having done this, they stretched the cables taut from the shore, twisting them with wooden windlasses, no longer keeping the two kinds of cable separate as before, but assigning two flax cables to each bridge and four papyrus ones. The thickness and appearance were the same, but proportionally the flax cables were heavier, a cubit of it weighing a talent. When the strait had been bridged, they sawed logs of timber and cut them to a length equal to the width of the floating bridge, and laid them in order on top of the stretched cables. And having set them side by side there, they fastened them together again. Having done this, they carried brushwood onto it, and having laid the brushwood in order, they carried earth on top of it and tamped it down. And having also tamped down the earth, they drew a fence along either side, so that the pack animals and horses would not be frightened at seeing the sea below them. When the work on the bridges were now complete, along with the works done at Athos, the mounds around the mouths of the canal, which had been made because of the surf, so that the mouths of the excavation should not be silted up, and the canal itself was reported complete. Then, having wintered there, the army, once prepared, set out with the coming of spring from Sardis to march on Abydos. As it set out, the sun left its place in the sky and vanished, although not a cloud was in sight and the air was utterly clear, and night came in place of day. Seeing and taking note of this, Xerxes grew concerned, and he asked the Magi what the apparition meant to foretell. They declared that the god was giving the Greeks advance notice that their cities would be destroyed, explaining that for the Greeks the sun serves as herald, and the moon for the Persians themselves. Learning this, Xerxes, overjoyed, pressed on with the march. As he was marching the army out, Pythias the Lydian, frightened by the apparition from the sky and emboldened by the gift Xerxes had given him, approached and spoke as follows. "Master, I would like to ask something of you, a thing that is light for you to grant but would be great for me." Xerxes, expecting that he would ask for almost anything rather than what he actually requested, said he would grant it and told him to say what he wanted. When he heard this, he spoke boldly as follows. "Master, I happen to have 5 sons, and it falls to all of them at once to campaign with you against Greece. You, O king, take pity on me, who have reached this age, and release one of my sons, the eldest, from the campaign, so that he may be the caretaker of me and of my property. Take the other 4 with you, and having accomplished what you intend, may you return home safely." Xerxes grew violently angry and answered as follows. "Wretched man, you dared, when I myself am campaigning against Greece, and leading my own sons and brothers and kinsmen and friends, to make mention of your son, though you are my slave, one who ought to follow along with his whole household, his wife included. Know this well. The heart lives in men's ears, hearing what is good, it floods the body with joy, while hearing the reverse, it swells with rage. When you did good deeds and offered more of the same, you will not be able to boast of having outdone the king in acts of generosity. But since you have now turned to shamelessness, you will not receive what you deserve, but less than you deserve. You and 4 of your sons are saved by your hospitality, but for the one you cling to most, you will be punished with his life." Having given this answer, he immediately ordered those assigned to the task to carry it out: to find the eldest of Pythias' sons and cut him in half, and having cut him, to set the two halves apart, placing one to the right of the road and one to the left, so the army could march through the space between. When they had done this, the army then passed through. Leading the way first were the baggage carriers and the pack animals, and after them a mixed army of every sort of people together, not sorted out by nation. And when more than half had passed by, a gap was left there, and these did not mix these belonged to the king. In front marched 1,000 cavalrymen, chosen out of all the Persians, then 1,000 spearmen, these two chosen out of all, with their spear points turned down toward the ground, then 10 sacred horses called Nisaean, adorned as beautifully as possible. The horses are called Nisaean for this reason. There is a great plain in Media called Nisaean, and it is this plain that produces the large horses. Behind these 10 horses came the sacred chariot of Zeus, pulled by a team of 8 white horses, and following behind on foot was a charioteer gripping the reins, since no human being takes that seat. After this rode Xerxes in person, in a chariot pulled by Nisaean horses, and beside him stood a charioteer named Patarampus, son of Atanes, a Persian. Xerxes rode out of Sardis in this fashion, but he would change over, whenever the fancy took him, from the chariot to a covered carriage. Behind him came the spearmen, the best and noblest of the Persians, 1,000 strong, holding their spears in the customary manner. Then 1,000 cavalry chosen from the Persians. Then, after the cavalry, chosen from the rest of the Persians, 10,000 men. These were infantry, and of them 1,000 had golden pomegranates on the butt-ends of their spears instead of spikes, and these enclosed the rest all around, while the other 9,000 who were within them had silver pomegranates. Those who turned their spears toward the ground also had golden pomegranates, and those who followed closest behind Xerxes had golden apples. Behind these 10,000 was stationed 10,000 Persian cavalry. After the cavalry, there was a gap of as much as 2 stadia, and then the rest of the host followed all mixed together. The army made its way from Lydia to the river Caicus and the land of Mysia, and setting out from the Caicus, keeping Mount Canes on its left, it went through Atarneus to the city of Cairn, and from there it made its way across the plain of Tebe, going past the city of Adramidium and Antandrus, the Pelasgian city. Then, keeping Mount Ida on its left, it entered the land of Ilium. And first, as it waded through the night beneath Ida, thunder and lightning bolts fell upon it and destroyed a good many people there. When the army arrived at the river Scamander, which was the first river, since setting out from Sardis and undertaking the march, whose water failed and was not sufficient for the army and the animals to drink. When Xerxes arrived at this river, he climbed up to Priam's citadel, Pergamum, wishing to view it. And after seeing it and inquiring into everything about it, he sacrificed 1,000 cattle to Athena of Ilium, and the Magi poured libations to the heroes. After they had done this, a panic fell upon the camp during the night. At daybreak the army set out from there, keeping on its left the cities of Rhoeteum, Ophranium, and Dardanus, which borders on Abydos, and on its right the Teucrian Gergides. When it came to be in the middle of Abydos, Xerxes wished to view the whole army, and a raised seat of white stone had been built beforehand for him on a hill there for this very purpose, the men of Abydos having made it at the king's earlier command. There he sat, and looking down upon the shore he viewed both the infantry and the ships, and as he watched he desired to see a race held among the ships. It took place, and the Phoenicians of Sidon won, and he was delighted both with the race and with the army. And when he saw the whole of the Hellespont hidden by ships, and all the shores and plains of Abydos filled with people, then Xerxes counted himself blessed, but afterward he wept. Artabanus his uncle, who earlier had spoken his mind openly, urging that Xerxes should not campaign against Greece, this man, perceiving that Xerxes had wept, asked him this, "O king, how far apart are the things you have just done from what you did a little while ago? Just now you counted yourself blessed, and now you weep." And he said, "Yes, for a feeling of pity came over me as I reckoned how brief the whole of human life is, seeing that of all these people here, not one will still be alive 100 years from now." And the other answered, saying, "Yet we suffer other things in the course of life more pitiable than that. For in so short a life no human being is so fortunate, neither these men nor any others, that the wish to die will not come upon him many times, and not once only, rather than to live. For the misfortunes that befall us and the sicknesses that trouble us make life, brief as it is, seem long. And so death has become, since life is so wretched, the most desirable refuge for man, and the God, having given us a taste of the sweetness of life, is found to be envious in this. Xerxes answered, saying, Artabanus, let us stop speaking of human life, since it is such as you describe it to be, and let us not brood over misfortunes while good matters are before us. Instead, answer me this, had the vision and the dream not shown itself so clearly, would you still keep your earlier opinion, refusing to let me march against Greece, or would you have changed your mind? Come, tell me this truly. And in reply he said, O king, may the dream vision that appeared come to pass just as we both hope. But I am still, even to this moment, full of fear and not in my right mind, considering many other things, and especially seeing that there are two things, the greatest of all, that are most hostile to you. Xerxes answered this with the following, You strange man, what are these two things you say are most hostile to me? Is it that the infantry seems to you deficient in number, and that the Greek army will prove many times greater than ours, or that our navy will fall short of theirs, or both of these together? For if in this respect our forces seem to you insufficient, one might very quickly gather another army. And he answered, saying, O king, no man of sense would find fault with this army, nor with the number of the ships. But if you gather more, the two things I speak of become still far more hostile to you. Land and sea are the two things I mean. For nowhere is there, as I reckon, a harbor anywhere so large that, when a storm arises, it would be able to receive this fleet of yours and keep the ship safe. And yet it is not enough that there be one such harbor, but there must be one all along the coast you sail past. Since then you have no harbors able to receive you, understand that misfortunes rule men, and not men their misfortunes. And so, of the two things, having spoken of one, I now go on to speak of the other. The land becomes hostile to you in this way. If nothing opposes you, the land becomes the more hostile to you the farther you advance, always lured onward and onward, since men never reach their fill of good fortune. And so, I tell you, supposing no one opposes you, the land, growing greater over greater time, will bring forth famine. But the best man would be one who, in deliberating, is fearful, reckoning that he will suffer every possible mischance, but who in action is bold. Xerxes answered with the following, Artabanus, you reason reasonably about each of these matters, but do not fear everything, nor reckon on everything alike. For if in every matter that comes up you wish to reckon on everything alike, you would accomplish nothing at all. It is better to face all things with confidence and suffer half of the terrors than to fear everything beforehand and suffer nothing at all. And if you dispute everything that is said without showing what is certain, you are bound to be mistaken in these matters just as much as the one who says the opposite. This, then, is equal on both sides. But how can a man, being human, know what is certain? I think in no way. So then, for those who wish to act, gains generally tend to come, but for those who reckon on everything and hesitate, they do not come so readily. You see to what power the Persians' affairs have advanced. If those kings who came before me had held opinions like yours, or, without holding such opinions, had had other advisors of that sort, you would never have seen these affairs come to this point. As it is, they brought them to this point by risking dangers, for great things tend to be won by great dangers. We then, following their example, are marching in the finest season of the year, and once we have subdued the whole of Europe, we will return home, having encountered famine nowhere nor suffered any other unpleasant thing. For we are marching carrying much provision with us, and moreover, whatever land and people we set foot upon, we shall have their grain as well. For we are marching against men who are farmers, not nomads. After this Artabanus said, O king, since you allow no fear of anything at all, at least accept this advice from me. For in matters of great weight one must necessarily extend the discussion further. Cyrus son of Cambyses subdued the whole of Ionia, except for the Athenians, to be tribute-paying to the Persians. These men, then, I advise you by no means to lead against their fathers, for even without them we are able to be superior to our enemies. For necessarily, if they follow, they will become the most unjust of men, by helping to enslave their mother city, or the most just, by helping to set it free along with us. Now if they become most unjust, they bring us no great gain, but if they become most just, they are capable of doing great harm to your army. Take to heart, then, the old saying, well spoken, that the end of a matter is not apparent at its beginning. Xerxes answered this, Artabanus, of the opinions you have expressed, you are mistaken above all in this one, in that you fear the Ionians may change sides. The very thing of which we have the greatest proof, of which you yourself are a witness, as are the others who campaigned with Darius against the Scythians, that the whole Persian army was capable of both destroying and preserving on these terms, and they had shown justice and loyalty, nothing displeasing. Besides this, since they have left children and wives and property in our land, you must not even imagine that they would attempt any revolt. So do not fear this either, but keep a good heart and preserve both my house and my kingship, for to you alone of all men I entrust my scepter. Having said this and sent Artabanus off to Susa, Xerxes next summoned the most eminent of the Persians, and once they had assembled in his presence, he addressed them thus. Men of Persia, I have gathered you together because I require this of you, to prove yourselves brave men and not to disgrace the deeds accomplished before now by the Persians, which are great and worth much, but rather let each man individually, and all of us together, show eagerness. For this good that is being pursued is shared by all in common. I proclaim to you the reasons why you must hold fast to this war with all your strength. From what I have learned, the men we march against are brave, and if we defeat them, no other army in the world will ever again stand against us. Now let us cross, after praying to the gods who watch over the Persians. On that day, they made preparations for the crossing, and on the next they waited, wishing to see the sun rise, burning all sorts of incense upon the bridges and strewing the road with myrtle boughs. And when the sun rose, Xerxes poured a libation into the sea from a golden bowl and made a prayer to the sun, asking that no misfortune befall him such as would stop him from subduing Europe before he reached its farthest limits. Having prayed, he threw the bowl into the Hellespont, together with a mixing bowl of gold and a sword of Persian make, the type called an echinax. I cannot say for certain whether he was dedicating these to the sun when he threw them into the sea, or whether he had repented of having scourged the Hellespont and was offering the sea these gifts in its place. When this had been done, the army crossed. By one of the bridges, the one toward the Pontus, went the infantry and all the cavalry. By the other, toward the Aegean, went the pack animals and the camp followers. Leading the way were first the 10,000 Persians, all crowned with wreaths, and after them the mixed army of every nation. That was the order for that day. But on the next, first came the cavalry and those who carried their spears pointed downward. These two wore wreaths. After them came the sacred horses together with the sacred chariot, then Xerxes himself with his spearmen and his 1,000 cavalrymen, followed finally by the remainder of the army. And at the same time, the fleet put out to sea for the opposite shore. I have also heard it said that the king crossed last of all. When Xerxes had crossed into Europe, he watched the army crossing under the lash. His army took 7 days and 7 nights to cross, without any pause. It is said that at this point, when Xerxes had already crossed the Hellespont, a man of the Hellespont said, "O Zeus, why have you taken the likeness of a Persian man and taken the name Xerxes instead of Zeus, in order to lay Greece waste, leading all mankind with you? For you could have done this without their help too." When all had crossed and were setting out on the march, a great portent appeared to them, which Xerxes made nothing of, although it was easily interpreted. A mare gave birth to a hare. It was easily interpreted in this way, that Xerxes was about to lead his army against Greece most proudly and magnificently, but would come running back to the same place for his own life. Another portent had also occurred to him while he was at Sardis. A mule gave birth to a mule that had double genitals, both male and female, with the male parts above. Taking no account of either portent, he continued on his way, with the infantry accompanying him. The fleet, sailing out of the Hellespont, made its way along the coast, doing the opposite of what the infantry did. For it sailed westward, making for the Sarpedonian headland, where it had been ordered to go and wait for him, while the land army made its way eastward, toward the sunrise, through the Chersonese, having on its right the tomb of Hel, Athamas's daughter, with the city of Cardia on its left, passing through the center of a city called Agora. From there, rounding the gulf called Melas and the river Melas, whose stream did not then suffice for the army but ran dry, crossing this river, from which the gulf also takes its name, he went westward, passing by Enus and Aeolian City and Lake Stentorus, until he arrived at Doriscus. Doriscus is a stretch of coast and a great plain of Thrace, through which flows a great river, the Hebrus. In it, a royal fortress had been built, the one called Doriscus, and a Persian garrison had been stationed in it by Darius from the time when he campaigned against the Scythians. So it seemed to Xerxes that this place was suitable for arranging and counting the army, and he did so. As for the ships, when they had all arrived at Doriscus, the admirals, at Xerxes' command, brought them to the stretch of coast adjoining Doriscus, where the Samothracian city of Sale is built, and Zone, and the promontory named Sarium marks its end. This region was in ancient times inhabited by the Scicones. Putting in at this stretch of coast, they hauled up the ships and let the men rest. Meanwhile, at Doriscus, Xerxes was counting the number of his army at this time. Now how large a force each people supplied in number, I cannot say for certain, for no one reports it. But the total number of the whole infantry force was found to be 1,700,000. They counted them in the following way. They gathered a myriad of men together in one place, and packing them together as tightly as possible, they drew a circle around them on the outside. Having drawn the circle and released the 10,000, they built a wall around the circle, reaching up to a man's navel in height. Having made this, they brought others into the enclosed space, until they had counted all of them in this manner. Having counted them, they arranged them by nation. The forces campaigning were as follows. The Persians were equipped in this manner. On their heads they wore soft felt caps called tiaras, and around their bodies they wore multicolored tunics with sleeves, with the look of iron scales like a fish's skin, and around their legs trousers, and instead of shields they carried wicker shields, and quivers hung beneath them. They had short spears, large bows, and reed arrows, and besides these, daggers hanging from their belts alongside their right thighs. Their commander was Otanes, father of Amestris, Xerxes' wife. In old times they were called by the Greek Sephenians, but by themselves and their neighbors Arteans. But when Perseus, son of Danae and Zeus, came to Cepheus son of Beleus and took his daughter Andromeda as wife, a son was born to him whom he named Perses, and he left him there, for Cepheus happened to have no male offspring. It was after this man that they took their name. The Medes campaigned equipped in this very same manner, for this equipment is Median, not Persian. The Medes provided as commander Tigranes, a man of the Achaemenid line. In old times they were called by everyone Arians, but when Medea of Colchis came from Athens to these Arians, they too changed their name. This is how the Medes themselves tell it about themselves. The Scythians, when campaigning, were equipped in all other respects like the Persians, but instead of felt caps they wore turbans. Anaph son of Otanes commanded the Scythians. The Hyrcanians were equipped just like the Persians, providing as leader Megapanus, who later became governor of Babylon. The Assyrians, when campaigning, wore bronze helmets on their heads, woven in a somewhat barbaric fashion not easy to describe, and they carried shields and spears and daggers similar to those of the Egyptians, and besides these, wooden clubs studded with iron and linen breastplates. These people are called by the Greek Syrians, but by the barbarians they are called Assyrians. Among these were the Chaldeans. Ataspe son of Artaxes commanded them. The Bactrians campaigned with headgear very close to that of the Medes, but with native reed bows and short spears. The Sacchi, who are Scythians, wore on their heads tall stiff caps rising to a point, and had put on trousers, and carried native bows and daggers, and besides these they also carried battle axes called Sagaris. These people, though they are Scythians, are called Amiagen Sacchi, for the Persians call all Scythians Sacchi. Hystaspes, son of Darius and Atossa, daughter of Cyrus, commanded the Bactrians and the Sacchi. The Indians, wearing garments made of tree fiber, carried reed bows and reed arrows tipped with iron. The Indians were equipped in this way, and they had been assigned to campaign together under Pharnazathers, son of Artabates. The Arians were equipped with Median bows, but in all else like the Bactrians. Sisemnes, son of Hydarnes, commanded the Arians. The Parthians, Chorasmians, Sogdians, Gandarians, and Dadaci campaigned equipped just like the Bactrians. These were commanded as follows. Of the Parthians and Chorasmians, Artabazus son of Pharnaces. Of the Sogdians, Azan son of Artius. Of the Gandarians and Dadaci, Artiphius son of Artabanus. The Caspians campaigned wearing cloaks of skin and carrying native reed bows and short swords. They were equipped in this way, providing as leader Ariamartus, brother of Artiphius. The Serengi wore conspicuous dyed garments and boots reaching up to the knee and in Median spearheads. Ferrandate, son of Megabazus, commanded the Sarangians. The Pactians wore cloaks of skin and carried native bows and daggers. The Pactians furnished as their commander Artaint, son of Ithimiters. The Eutians, the Mycians, and the Pericanians were equipped just like the Pactians. These were their commanders. Arsamenes, son of Darius, commanded the Eutians and Mycians, and Cerimeter, son of Oabazus, commanded the Pericanians. The Arabians wore girded robes and carried long bows curved back on their right side. The Ethiopians were clad in leopard and lion skins and carried long bows made from palmwood strips, no shorter than 4 cubits, and on these small reed arrows, tipped not with iron but with a sharpened stone, the very stone used for engraving seals. They also carried spears, tipped with a gazelle's horn sharpened into the shape of a spearpoint, and they also carried knobbed clubs. Going into battle, they smeared half their body with gypsum, the other half with red ochre. The Arabians and the Ethiopians settled above Egypt were commanded by Arsames, son of Darius, and of Artistone, daughter of Cyrus, whom Darius loved most of all his wives, and for whom he had a golden statue made, hammered out of solid gold. These Ethiopians and Arabians above Egypt, then, were commanded by Arsames, while the Ethiopians from the Sunrise side, for 2 contingents of Ethiopians took part in the campaign, were attached to the Indians, differing from the others in no way in appearance, but only in speech and in hair. For the Ethiopians from the east have straight hair, while those from Libya have the wooliest hair of all mankind. These Ethiopians from Asia were, for the most part, equipped like the Indians, though on their heads they wore horses' scalped foreheads, ears and mane included. The mane served in place of a crest, while the horses' ears were kept standing stiffly upright. As shields, they used the hides of cranes. The Libyans wore leather gear and used javelins hardened by fire. Their commander was Messages, son of Orizus. The Paphlagonians took the field wearing woven helmets on their heads, small shields, spears that were not large, and in addition javelins and daggers. On their feet, they wore native boots reaching to mid-calf. The Lygians, the Mashanians, the Mariandinians, and the Syrians took the field equipped the same way as the Paphlagonians. These Syrians are called Cappadocians by the Persians. Dodas, son of Megasidrus, commanded the Paphlagonians and Mashanians, while Gabrias, son of Darius and Artistone, commanded the Mariandinians, the Lygians, and the Syrians. The Phrygians were equipped very much like the Paphlagonians, with only slight differences. The Phrygians, as the Macedonians say, were called Brigs as long as they lived in Europe as neighbors of the Macedonians, but when they moved into Asia, along with the land, they changed their name too, to Phrygians. The Armenians were equipped just like the Phrygians, being colonists of the Phrygians. Both these peoples together were commanded by Artachmes, who had a daughter of Darius as his wife. The Lydians carried arms very close to the Greek style. The Lydians were called Meonians in ancient times and took their present name from Lydus, son of Aedes, when they changed their name. The Mycians wore native helmets on their heads, small shields, and used fire-hardened javelins. These are colonists of the Lydians and are called Olympiani after Mount Olympus. Artaphernes, son of Artaphernes, who invaded at Marathon together with Dades, commanded the Lydians and Mycians. The Thracians took the field wearing fox-skin caps on their heads, tunics on their bodies, and over these cloaks of many colors, and on their feet and shins boots of fawnskin. Besides this, they had javelins, light shields, and small daggers. Once they crossed over into Asia, they were called Bithynians, though before that, as they themselves say, they were called Strymonians, since they dwelt on the Strymon. They say they were driven from their homes by the Teucrians and Mycians. Bassases, son of Artabanus, commanded the Thracians in Asia. They carried small shields of raw oxhide, and each man carried 2 Lycian-made hunting spears. On their heads they wore bronze helmets, and on the helmets were fixed bronze ox ears and horns, along with crests. Their shins were bound with strips of red cloth. It is among these men that an oracle of Ares is found. The Cables, who are Meonians, called Lassonians, wore the same equipment as the Cilicians, which I will describe when in going through the list I come to the position of the Cilicians. The Milians carried short spears and had their garments fastened with brooches. Some of them carried Lycian bows, and on their heads wore caps made of hide. Batters, son of Histanes, commanded all of these. The Moschi wore caps of wood on their heads and carried small shields and spears, but their spearheads were large. The Tiberenians, the Macrons, and the Mossinosi took the field equipped just like the Moschi. These were arranged under the following commanders. Ariamartis, son of Darius and of Parmes, daughter of Smerdes, son of Cyrus, commanded the Moschi and Tiberenians. Ardax, Charismus's son, governor of Sestos on the Hellespont, commanded the Macrons and Mossinosi. The mares wore native plated helmets on their heads, small leather shields, and javelins. The Colchians wore wooden helmets on their heads, small shields of raw oxhide, short spears, and in addition carried knives. Ferendates, son of Tespes, commanded the mares and Colchians. The Illyrodians and Saspers took the field armed just like the Colchians. Masistius, son of Cerameters, commanded these. The island peoples coming from the Red Sea, from the islands where the king settles the people called the deportees, wore clothing and arms very close to the Median style. Mardont, son of Bagius, commanded these islanders. He served as a general at Mycale and died there in battle in the second year after these events. These were the peoples who campaigned by land and were mustered into the infantry. This army, then, was commanded by those named above. They were the ones who organized and numbered the men and appointed the commanders of thousands and of 10,000s, while the commanders of 10,000s appointed the commanders of hundreds and of tens. There were other officers over the units and the nations as well. These, then, were the commanders named above. But the generals over these and over the whole infantry army were Mardonius, son of Gabrias, and Triton Teachum, son of Artabanus. The Artabanus who had advised against campaigning against Greece, and Smerdomenes, son of Autanes, both of these being sons of brothers of Darius and thus cousins to Xerxes, and Masist, son of Darius and Atossa, and Jurgis, son of Ariazus, and Megabizus, son of Zopyrus. These were the generals of the whole infantry apart from the 10,000. Of these 10,000 chosen Persians, Hydarnes, son of Hydarnes, was the general. These Persians were called the Immortals. For this reason, if any one of them was removed from the number, whether by death or by sickness, another man was chosen to replace him, and so they were never more nor fewer than 10,000. Of all the troops, the Persians displayed the finest array, and they themselves were the best soldiers. They had the equipment already described, and besides that, they stood out for the abundance of gold they wore, plain to see. They were accompanied by covered wagons, in which rode their concubines and a large, well-equipped retinue of servants. Camels and pack animals carried food for them separately from the rest of the soldiers. All these nations use cavalry, except that not all of them provided horses, but only the following did: the Persians equipped the same way as their infantry, except that some of them wore on their heads beaten pieces of bronze and iron. There are certain nomadic people called the Sagartians, Persian by race and by language, but with equipment made partway between the Persian and the Pactian styles. They provided 8,000 horsemen, and they are not accustomed to carry weapons of bronze or iron except daggers, but they use ropes plaited from leather thongs, and trusting in these they go to war. Their manner of fighting is this: when they engage the enemy, they throw out the ropes, which have nooses at the end. Whatever they catch, whether horse or man, they drag toward themselves, and the victims, entangled in the coils, are destroyed. This is their manner of fighting, and they were posted beside the Persians. The Medes wore the same gear they had in the infantry, and so did the Scythians. The Indians were equipped the same as in the infantry, but rode both mounted horses and chariots. Under the chariots ran horses and wild asses. The Bactrians were equipped just as in the infantry, as were the Caspians, similarly equipped. As for the Libyans, they too carried the same gear as their infantry, and all of them likewise drove chariots. In the same way, the Caspians and Peracanians were equipped just as in the infantry. The Arabians had the same equipment as in the infantry, but all of them rode camels, which are not inferior to horses in speed. These are the only peoples that supplied cavalry. The number of the cavalry totaled 80,000, not counting the camels and chariots. The other horsemen, meanwhile, were arranged by units, while the Arabians were stationed last, for since the horses could not endure the presence of the camels, they were placed at the rear, so that the cavalry would not be frightened. The cavalry commanders were Harmamithers and Tithius, sons of Dades. Their third co-commander, Pharnaces, had been left behind at Sardis, ill. For as they were setting out from Sardis, he had met with an unwonted misfortune. As he rode along, a dog darted beneath his horse's legs, and the horse, caught off guard, panicked, reared upright, and threw Farnaces off, who fell and vomited blood, and his illness turned into consumption. As for the horse, they did just as he had ordered at the outset, leading it away the servants, at the spot where he had thrown down his master, cut off his legs at the knees. That was how Farnaces was relieved of his command. The number of the triremes came to 1,207, and they were furnished by the following peoples. The Phoenicians, together with the Syrians of Palestine, furnished 300, equipped as follows. On their heads they had helmets made very close to the Greek style, and they wore linen breastplates and carried shields without rims and javelins. These Phoenicians in ancient times dwelt, as they themselves say, on the Red Sea, and from there, having crossed over, they now dwell along Syria's coastline. This portion of Syria, together with the entire stretch reaching to Egypt, bears the name Palestine. The Egyptians furnished 200 ships. These men had on their heads woven helmets and hollow shields with large rims and spears suited to fighting at sea and great battle axes. Most of them wore breastplates and carried great swords. That was how they were equipped. The Cypriots furnished 150 ships, equipped as follows. Their kings had their heads bound with turbans, while the rest wore tunics, but otherwise were dressed like the Greeks. Among them are the following peoples, some from Salamis and Athens, some from Arcadia, some from Cythnus, some from Phoenicia, some from Ethiopia, as the Cypriots themselves say. The Cilicians furnished 100 ships. These in turn, on their heads, had helmets of their own country's style, and instead of shields carried light wicker shields made of raw oxhide and wore woolen tunics. Each man carried 2 javelins and a sword made very close to the Egyptian knives. These people were in ancient times called Hypaceans, but took their present name from Cilix, son of Agenor, a Phoenician man. The Pamphylians furnished 30 ships, equipped with Greek arms. These Pamphylians are descendants of those scattered from Troy together with Amphilochus and Chalcis. The Lycians furnished 50 ships, wearing breastplates and greaves. They carried bows of cornel wood and unfeathered reed arrows and javelins and had a goatskin slung about their shoulders, and on their heads felt caps crowned round with feathers. They also carried daggers and sickles. The Lycians were called Termoli, being originally from Crete, but took their present name from Lycus, son of Pandion, an Athenian man. The Dorians from Asia furnished 30 ships, carrying Greek arms and being originally from the Peloponnese. The Carians furnished 70 ships, equipped in all other respects like the Greeks, but they also carried sickles and daggers. What these people were called before has been told earlier in my account. The Ionians furnished 100 ships, equipped as Greeks. Now the Ionians, during the period when they lived in the region of the Peloponnese now called Achaea, and before Danaus and Xuthus arrived in the Peloponnese, were called, as the Greeks say, Pelasgian Aegeleans, but after Ion son of Xuthus, Ionians. The islanders furnished 17 ships armed as Greeks, and this too is a Pelasgian people, which was later called Ionian, by the same reasoning as the 12 city Ionians from Athens. The Aeolians furnished 60 ships, equipped as Greeks and formerly called Pelasgians, as the Greek account has it. The Hellespontines, except the people of Abydos, for the Abydeans had been assigned by the king to remain in their own territory as guards of the bridges, the rest of those from the Pontus who took part in the campaign furnished 100 ships and were equipped as Greeks. These were colonists of the Ionians and Dorians. On board all the ships as marines were Persians, Medes, and Sacchi. Of these, the best sailing ships were furnished by the Phoenicians, and among the Phoenicians, by the Sidonians. Over all of these, and over the units assigned to the infantry, each people had its own native commanders, whom I, since I am not compelled by the demands of my inquiry to do so, do not mention. For neither were the commanders of each people particularly worthy of note, and in each nation there were as many commanders as there were cities, and they followed not as generals, but, like the rest on campaign, as slaves. But the generals who held full command and ruled over each of the nations, as many of them as were Persians, I have already named. Of the naval force, the generals were Ariabenes son of Darius, Prexasps son of Aspathanes, Megabazus son of Megabates, and Achaemenes son of Darius. Of the Ionian and Carian forces, Ariabenes son of Darius and of the daughter of Gabrias was general. Of the Egyptians, Achaemenes, full brother of Xerxes on both sides, was general. and of the rest of the force, the other two were generals. The triaconters and pentaconters and light boats and the long horse transport vessels, when gathered together, came to a total of 3,000. Of those who sailed on board, the most notable after the generals were these: Tetramnestus of Sidon, son of Enesis, Matin of Tyre, son of Seram, Myrbelus of Aretas, son of Agbalus, Cyanesis of Cilicia, son of Aromdin, Cyberniscus of Lycia, son of Sicas, and of the Cypriots Gorgas, whose father was Chersus, and Timonax, whose father was Timagoras, and of the Carians, Hishia son of Timnes, and Pigers son of Hisseldamas, and Damasithimus son of Candals. Of the other unit commanders I make no mention, since nothing compels me to, but of Artemisia I make particular note of my wonder, since she was a woman who campaigned against Greece. After her husband's death, holding the sovereignty herself, and though she had a son who was still a young man, she took the field out of spirit and courage, no necessity compelling her to do so. Her name was Artemisia. Lygdamis was her father, and her lineage traced to Halicarnassus on her father's side and to Crete on her mother's. She commanded the men of Halicarnassus, Cos, Nisiros, and Calydna, furnishing 5 ships. Of the whole fleet, after the ships of the Sidonians, hers were the most renowned, and among all the allies she gave the king the best counsel. Of the cities I have listed as under her command, I declare the whole people to be Dorian, the Halicarnassians being of Troezenian stock, the rest of Epidaurian. So much has been told of the naval force. As for Xerxes, once the army had been counted and arranged, he wished to drive through it himself and review it.